Welcome to PTW Office Hours, where we invite authors, writers, publishing professionals to have casual conversations around craft. Grab your journal, a cup of tea or coffee, and get ready to take notes. This is PTW Office Hours, brought to you by Permission to Write.
Awesome, because we don't want to miss anything. So I'm very excited, y'all, to have Faja Muhammad with us today, who is not only just an esteemed and amazing writer, y'all, like, okay, wait till y'all get into this work in progress. Like, wait until this work in progress is out into the world. Faja is an amazing writer. She's been awarded fellowships from amazing places like Tin House, Jack Jones Literary Arts Retreat, Rhode Island Writers Colony. I mean, you name it. She is really like stumping with the big dogs in all kinds of ways. But she is also the co-editor of this amazing, like, I feel like it's just like almost like an archival piece of history. I really enjoyed just like my quick foray, kind of like jumping around to different essays. I look forward to being able to spend a little bit more time with it, but it's called How We Stay Free. This is what it looks like. Notes on a Black Uprising. I ordered my copy from Bookshop, but you can pretty, where else can you get it, Faja?
You can get it at, well, of course, like Amazon, if you want to go that route. Okay. CommonNotionsPress.org or CommonNotions.org. It's also local. I think it's at Harriet's. It's at Making World Bookstores in West Philly. So I think it's wherever books are sold.
Oh, that's perfect. So I'll include the Bookshop link because, you know, we have it on our storefront at PTW. because, you know, I first met Faja through our writing group that we had in Philly. Janine introduced us, and she's just been such an amazing contribution to like our little community and group, along with Jared, who's also featured in the anthology. So without further ado, like, let's just get into it and talk about this process. So one of the first things I wanted to actually ask you about, which feeds into the first question of like this process of co-editing and what that was like, but even before that, I realized, like, how did the book actually come to be? Like, did you work on a proposal for the anthology? How did that process really kick off for you? What was it like?
Well, first, hello, everyone. I see some familiar faces. Hey, Shamika. Hey, Constance. Hi, Danielle. Hi, Audrey. Hi, Zora. So thank you for having me on Office Hours. Permission to Write is very near and dear to my heart. So this is exciting. To start, yeah, I think it was a lot. It started and then it did not stop and we kept doing it. But the way that it came to be was, it was a project that came across my desk. So I'm involved with Blue Stoop, which is another literary organization in Philadelphia, nonprofit that hosts author events, classes, education. And Emma Eisenberg, she had found out about the Independence Media Grant, which is a media grant in Philadelphia. Basically, that's just was open-ended. Like, it was for any kind of media, any kind of storytelling throughout the city. And she had passed it over to Chris Rogers, who's a program director at the Paul Robeson House and Museum. Oh, thank you for that, for the link. Yeah, Blue Soup is awesome. So Emma, she's just totally tapped into everything that's happening in the city. She passed that over to Chris and was like, hey, like, this is a really cool grant. Do you have any ideas about what you might want to do with it? And Chris is just like awesome because he's also very tapped in as a function of like being at the Robeson House as program director, but he's also doing his PhD in literacy studies at Penn. So he's just super duper connected, and his idea was about telling stories from 2020. So we were just like right in the thick of it. It was very early. It was right before the first lockdown, I think, that they had communicated. And he, you know, was like, I would love to do something with this, but do you have anybody who you think would be interested to maybe work on it with me? So she emailed an introduction between the two of us. And I was like, very early on, like, this seems like a very cool thing. Have no clue what it's going to be. When we first thought about it, we didn't think about it as a book. I think we originally thought about it as a website, maybe like a living archive that we could consistently document stories from 2020. We did the grant proposal. We shot for, I want to say, somewhere about 35 grand. We probably could have done a lot more. It was very important to us that the contributors get paid and that we have money to support them in telling their stories. And that's how it started.
Well, I love that. So it's a little bit of a like non-traditional route where like, oh, you have a proposal for a book, you write it, you go to the place. So I love hearing like a bit of a variety of how really books come to be. That was one of the things I feel like I've learned the most over the last year or so is like, there's not one way of how books really kind of start.
Yeah.
So this process, you're working with Christopher Rogers, who works with Paul Robeson House. What was that kind of like, what is being a co-editor? Like, how does that even work? Like, what is the distribution of work? How do you approach like managing who manages what?
Is the darkness getting to you guys? Cause I'm like, I feel like you guys can't see me. Like you're just talking to like a blank screen.
Yeah, there you go. If okay. This way.
Yep, the light is like, okay. yeah, it was new to me. Cause
wait, Faja, I muted you by accident trying to let someone in. Okay, there you go. I'm so sorry. Start that
no
over.
No problem. What did I say? I said it was new to me. So I had the same type of like questions too around like, well, how does this work? How are we going to do this? So very early on, I mean, I think Chris was like, he was very much the steward of the house and of Paul Robeson's legacy. So being that it was a project of the house and it wasn't like either of our individual projects, we always had to keep in mind how the project was reflecting the house. There's an executive director, Janice Sykes Ross, who came on. So the team at the house, Ms. Renoka Michael and Ms. Sherry Howard, they of course, you know, had a lot of input in the project. But very early on, I think we had the conception that we wanted to do open submissions, open calls, of course, just to open it up to anybody in the public, organizers, protesters, activists, writers, artists to submit. But then also we had a list of people who were friends and engaged with the house who Chris knew were actually out in the field doing work that we reached out to as well. So it was a combination of both of those kind of pipelines into the work. And honestly, we really much did pretty much everything together from like the initial conception of, okay, like this is, we're going to do an anthology. We're going to do a complementing website. He tackled a lot of the business and a lot of the outreach. And then I tackled a lot of the editorial support. So then we also figured out that very early on, we were going to need help because I think we were dealing with something like 25 pieces when we finally landed on it. So very early on, we pulled on Jasmine Combs, who's a poet in Philadelphia, to help us support with editing the poetry. And then we pulled in Jarrett, Michael Lowe, who's also a phenomenal writer, an alumni of Penn, to help us with all of the nonfiction pieces. So we assembled the team, and then we kind of just started to get the influx of submissions. The process was never linear. Like some pieces we were able to kind of knock out like directly. Some pieces we had to go back and forth. We hopped on Zoom so many times to just be able to like interview the contributors, because a lot of the contributors were not like traditional classical writers. So a lot of them were just busy working and trying to further their actions, like the housing justice action, the Black Radical Collective. Like these are people that are just in the thick of it that are working, right, and trying to meet their demands. So we were just made ourselves open and available to hop on calls to be able to get the pieces to finish.
I love that you talked a little bit about kind of like really serving like Paul Robeson's like legacy and like mission, you know, and so I feel like that might be in the forefront of this question, but like, how do you really kind of alternate between your editing and writing brain, right? So like, what are some of the biggest differences of approach when it comes to say like editing other people's pieces versus like when you're working on your own?
That's a good question. I think I have so much practice. Like I was that person, and maybe like you guys can relate. I was that person in college who like my friends would call me and be like, help me write this paper. And I would just like sit on the phone with them talking for hours. They'd be like, say that part again, repeat that part. I'm gonna write that down. So I feel like that was like practice for this. I think early on the editorial strategy was that we weren't gonna give a lot of direction in terms of like what the contributors could write, what they wanted to write. We didn't have any kind of overarching politics, even though Robeson does, the house itself does, right? So we had to juggle a lot of those things, but
for Chris and I think it was very much like, these are personal reflections, these are personal stories. So we want them to feel like personal stories. We don't want to put a lot of additional layering or our own beliefs or the house's beliefs on top of them, right? Without them, of course, like being on the up and up, no curse words, things that, you know, we definitely wanted to be respectful. But for me, it was really me thinking about how would I want to be edited? What I'm thinking about when I'm submitting a piece, one, understanding that these are, you know, very serious stories. These are very like tenuous experiences that many of the contributors have had. I'm thinking specifically of the Philadelphia Housing Action piece. Like that piece is just like tremendous in terms of what those people experienced at the encampments, what they had to go through. It's very honest about some of the failures, about a lot of the lessons, things that, you know, people on the outside looking in don't really get to know. So I think we were always very specific from an editorial standpoint to allow a lot of space for flexibility and also support the contributors if there was something that they did not want to say, to give them the final say ultimately in what they wanted to promote. But with that, we are editors, so we do then still have to like pull stuff out of people. So I think it was just a lot of asking questions, things that I didn't understand, things that I thought maybe the readers might not understand, really just trying to continue to poke and push and delve deeper to see if we can maybe pull that out of the contributors. I love examples. So I'm also thinking like Jazz Riley, they're a PhD student at Yale in African American Studies. They wrote about like their very personal experience in West Philly after Walter Wallace was killed, and how like right on their block there was like a police shootout. And just trying to like, you know, inquire them and poke them for more clarity, for just like to go a layer beneath, right? Always understanding that, of course, like this is a sensitive conversation, sensitive topic, and not wanting to make sure that they recognize that they have full autonomy over their stories.
Right. Which is, you know, I feel like one of the biggest questions I'm always asking myself in any type of editing scenario is, am I making sure that I'm staying true to their voice and what they want to say versus like how I would have said it? Like, you know what I mean? Like that is sometimes like learning how to turn that part of your brain off can sometimes be like the biggest challenge. But I love that you kind of were able to really like step aside to like just the importance of letting like real authenticity and transparency shine through, like to your point, you know, by keeping some parameters around it, but really kind of trying to like dig. This project really makes me think, because it is such like a, you know, like a bit of like a time capsule and really like capturing a moment in history. It makes me think of the Nina Simone quote that really talks about how it's an artist's job to reflect the times, right? And I think about that quote so often and what that kind of means. And so for you, like, what do you feel like is that responsibility, kind of, if any? Because I don't think that it always means like one particular thing, right? Just me. But for you, with a project like this, how does that really kind of manifest in your world, that thought?
Yeah, I saw that question, and that was one that kind of stuck out to me too. I was like, oh man, she's asking these hard questions. She's going like for the heavy hitters. I think in this project specifically, it was just that, like understanding that this is a time capsule. This is a segment, like a bite-sized time capsule of a much, much larger thing, like not just in Philly, in Minneapolis, in New York, in LA, like all over the world, right? So we really did at the very beginning want to like position it. Like this is not the entire story. This is just a subset of the story, right? Like this is not, and it's also not any one direction, right? And I think that goes to what you were saying too about like, okay, the artist's job is to reflect the times, but that doesn't mean that it has to look like any particular way, right? It's their reflection of the times. So within the project, we also wanted to allow for that flexibility and that fluidity, right? And somebody is coming out, so one second.
No worries.
Thank you.
It is very real life out here in the Zoom streets.
I've been on work like, okay, wait one second. But yeah, I think that it was that we didn't want to also put any one particular politic, right? Like the project does speak to the Black radical tradition, right? The idea that Black people have been resisting their entire lives, right? Since we got on these shores, so that 2020 wasn't something brand new, right? It was one step in a long tradition that has been existing and will continue to exist. But we also wanted to leave fluidity that it doesn't have to exist in one particular way. So one particular thing that I thought was really great was that we also included, well, we talked about like the protests and the larger actions and like the police vehicles being set on fire and all the actions that took place on like 676 and down Center City. We also talked about the actions that were taking place in West Philly, so like Malcolm X Park. But then even deeper than that, we also talked about like the looting and included art from a photographer, Corey Hairston, who actually went down West Philly to some of like the sneaker shops where people were looting, and like not putting any judgment over it or any kind of additional context over a judgment call or any kind of like moralism over it. It's like, these are all the things that happen during uprisings, and we want to make sure that we document all of them. And whether you agree or disagree is really up to you and how you engage with the project. But it's our story as artists to tell the entire truth, to reflect the entire set of circumstances, and not guide people any one direction or any particular way.
Mm-hmm. So with something as like polarizing, with so much like history, right? Because the uprisings are really rooted in, like you said, this tradition of resistance since the beginning, right? Since Amistad, right? Like since... Right. Since before, right? So what does like self-care look like in this process? Because I know within this community, we've talked about what writing hard things looks like. And so did you have any like rituals in regard to, because, you know, in a sense, I would imagine in editing, you're kind of reliving a lot of this. I like think definitely being like central, like at the time I was living in Philly, like not too far from 52nd Street. And I remember being outside and like us trying to go to the grocery store and literally like people were looting. Like it was wild. Like it was like kind of, it was crazy. But you know, we just was like, do what you got to do, you know? And we just went to the other supermarket, whichever other supermarket we could get to. So being right in the center of it, you know, kind of like how were you able to, or did you even find a need for like self-care kind of in this process of reliving these really tragic kind of stories and things like that?
That's a good question. Cause I think like while we were doing it, I mean, I didn't particularly, think about myself in terms of like what I needed, because I think we were just like so furiously just trying to get it together. We started the book, it kicked off around July, so after the bulk of the riots and after a lot of the actions that took place in the city, and then I want to say we submitted the manuscript like the end of last year. So it was a little bit over a year process of putting it together. But specifically to speak to self-care, I think we also were also very cognizant of holding that space and self-care for the contributors too, right? Because I mean, they were doing the bulk of the work in terms of reflecting, thinking back to those time periods, thinking back to their experiences. So we were very aware of like asking too much of the contributors. Cause I also think just in like you said, the larger conversation about art and black artists, people ask so much of us, period, right? Like, oh, it's Black History Month, like, can you write this, can you do a trauma piece, can you do a Black joy piece, can you do a this piece? And it's like, ultimately we wanted to make sure that it was something that they really wanted to do, and we also wanted to hold space that if it was too much or if it was just something that they did not feel an inkling to do, that they had the right of refusal to just be like, you know, no. In terms of just how we were able to do it, I think it's pretty interesting too, is like, this was also all going on during COVID, right? Like when like COVID was very much in the thick, right? It's still here, but we did most of the stuff through Zoom. We did not start meeting up with people until like fairly recently. So I think that was a bit of it, to be able to keep distance. It's funny though, because I don't even think I thought about the heaviness of it until I actually like got the book in my hand and was able to flip through it and think like, wow, like there is a lot of stuff here that is very serious and is very deep, but I think we also try to figure out ways to counter that. So there is a prayer at the end by Charlene Griffin, who is a doula and a food activist, and she writes this beautiful prayer piece in it. Jared's piece, I think, is really beautiful because it talks about just like Black resistance with kids. So we tried to find avenues and entries into the work that also allowed for a reader to be able to pick up this book and say, okay, like, I'm not just about to be plummeted with, you know, story after story after story of protest, that there are going to be actual threads that they can pick out and they feel good, right? That they feel educational, that they feel informative, and that they feel actionable.
I love that. And Jared's piece was definitely kind of, you know, yeah, definitely a great piece. And I love that you talked about timeline, because that was one of the questions I was going to kind of circle back to, but timeline is great. So the process took a little over a year, from July to the end of last year, to, you know, hand in a completed manuscript, which is great. I guess like a couple other questions, and then I of course want to make sure that anyone else on the call who has questions can ask. But essentially, you know, I guess I'm wondering what are some of your like earliest memories of collective power? Because, you know, and it made me think of that Jared's piece about like children, and he talked about, you know, not really understanding all the implications of the Rodney King case, being young, but understanding how it was shaping kind of people around him. I think for me, Rodney King really didn't register, but it registered when OJ was on trial, kind of like the polarizingness of it, and that being after Rodney King, and like even just how those things like spoke to each other, right? So I guess I just want to talk about, you know, what for you were some of those earliest memories of collective power and your own experience.
That's so funny that you mentioned OJ, because anytime somebody brings it up, I think of the argument I had with my best friend in the Ogun's library in like fifth grade over the OJ verdict. Like, we were going at it. I think I was just like, well, we don't know if he did it. She was like, he definitely did it. And I'm just like, well, he's innocent until proven guilty. They just want to run and roll the Black man. It was just, I just remember that argument being so formative. Yes. For me, and it still is to this day, right? We still have so many opinions, but for me, it's interesting, though, because I feel like, well, I don't think I was raised in a radical, like very like in that traditional kind of like Black radical sense household. Like those things were never directly addressed in my family. I was raised by very conscious radical parents and people. My parents were entrepreneurs. So they were raised and brought up in the Nation of Islam, and then they converted to Sunni Islam, both from Philadelphia, dad from North Philly, mom from West Philly. So very much like steeped in Black Philadelphia, always a Malcolm X poster on our wall, went to Afrocentric day camp. So it's kind of some of the things that just like, as I was brought up as like a Philly Muslim, like those things just kind of like were naturally there. So I don't necessarily know if I really ever thought about them consciously. And even as like I got older, I feel like they were always there, but I never really like formalized them in the way that I feel like a lot of young people do today, which I think is like really beautiful because they have a deep understanding and consciousness about the world. Whereas I feel like I was just kind of going along to get along. Oh, this makes sense to me. Like, of course, like people share their freedom, like not really thinking about it. But I just remember tentpole events, like protesting when Trayvon was murdered, in college, being a part of like a women's studies minor. So I was very steeped in like feminist practices in college. So I think these things have just always been ingrained in me in terms of it's going to take a lot more of us to figure this out. And I think I also take a very deep approach in understanding that these are very complicated problems, right? Like I think if we I'm always just thinking about like, it's deeper than what we think it is, and to give ourselves a lot more grace in the process of trying to solve these very big issues. So I think that's how I tend to lead when I'm thinking about collectivism, when I'm thinking about Black liberation, when I'm thinking about ways that we can get freer, get more free, stay free. Some people might think that we're not free at all. But when I'm thinking about these complicated topics, I'm always thinking about grace. And I think what I hope comes through in the book in terms of collectivism is that it does take a village, as cliche as that sounds. It does take an entire group of people to do things, to make things actually happen, to affect change, and that it is possible. And I'll say one of the things, maybe just like a quick lesson that I've taken away from working on the book is, oh no, I'm dark. You know, I could be a little bit cynical. And like, again, these topics are complex and hard, and it feels like, it doesn't feel like Black people have been fighting for liberation, like you said, since before. So there is fatigue, but reading so many of the stories and pieces and being able to see that when people act in concert together, when people have a unified vision for what they want, things can happen. Like the housing, the Philadelphia Housing Action, I always go back to this because it was one of those pieces that just really astounded me, that they were able to get, you know, PHA and the city to give them 50 houses. And I have to, oh, thank you so much, Kayla, that I have to speak on one of the contributors who helped us to work on that piece, Jan Benetech, who also goes by Nadira Hood. She actually recently passed away last week due to complications from COVID. And it was just so phenomenal to just hear her talk about all the work that she had been doing for years, even before 2020, to combat just PHA and some of their just like, you know, inhumane practices and like the over-policing of people in public housing. So I really just want to lift her up and lift up her family during this difficult time. But that was just one of the things that really astounded me in terms of, you know, there is so much talk, but when you do put action and togetherness behind a goal, it can be accomplished.
Oh, yeah. And I hear you, because when I feel like I was having those debates with my mom, you know, during the uprising, and, you know, just that like generational difference and her kind of being like, well, but they don't have to do that. Right. Like, you know, like that kind of thing. Yep. And me just being like, I think one of my understandings about collective power has definitely been like, yes, it does. Is it going to take a group? And then it's also going to take making people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't just continue to be comfortable because we've been comfortable. Like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, we've been trying to make people comfortable. So, yeah. You know, not to like put too much judgment one way or the other, you know, to your point of like what's right and what's wrong. But it's like, it gets blurred mm-hmm. because, you know, you do have to kind of like understand what moves people and what moves things, and money mm-hmm. is a major factor in that.
That's funny that you say that too, because I think the other, I think, beautiful thing about the collection and how it came together was that it also presented a lot of strategies. Mm-hmm. So I think for people that might not necessarily like, you know, have the view or maybe haven't done movement work and aren't organizers and aren't, you know, full-time activists, like this is what they do. They are gifted at organizing people. You might just not have the understanding of what it does take to like get support, to drum up action. Like, this is a year-round thing, right? It doesn't just happen. It's not like, okay, 2020 happened. Unfortunately, George Floyd is murdered. And then like everybody takes to the streets. Like, there is so much coordination and collaboration happening. And a lot of the stuff, the organizations that are featured here and also ones that are not featured here have been doing this work year round. Like, they have food drives. They've got all other programs throughout the year because they're able to drum up the support for when something like this does happen. They're able to say, okay, guys, we're going to meet here on Art Museum steps. We need everybody to come out and be in solidarity and support. So I think like also that like collective power throughout the year is important too, not just when an incident happens.
Right. I love that. And I love featuring strategies because, you know, sometimes people are looking for like, well, where do I start, mm-hmm. you know, and what do I do? So that's really powerful. All right. I want to make sure I leave time for questions. I have probably like one other question for myself, but I just want to open it up to the floor because I know sometimes people have to jump in and out and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So I want to make sure if anyone has questions, they have the opportunity to ask. Feel free to ask about the book or about like any of writing process, because, you know, office hours is really about like one, being able to like promote and highlight folks that are doing amazing work and what they're doing. But this is also your opportunity to dig into other people's craft, right? I'm always writing to y'all about how I'm doing stuff. So I like bringing in other perspectives of like approach and how they're going about things. So feel free to kind of ask the wide range of craft questions or particular to the book.
I might not know, but I'm still trying to figure it out myself.
Listen, we are all in this together, okay? Because I'm still trying to figure it out. Okay, so Zora said, I have a great idea for an anthology, but wondering if I need more street cred before, I'm scrolling.
Before she launches the idea to get like a Patreon, get support submissions, etc.
Okay.
My instinct is no. Like I had never edited an anthology. I've done editorial work in like digital marketing, which is my 9 to 5. So I do have that background in working with writers, but in terms of like creative support, no, I just did a lot of research. I would say maybe in terms of connections, what was easy for us in terms of trying to get people involved was that Chris worked at the Robeson House and he was super connected in Philadelphia movement circles, but I don't think that that's a requirement. You know, I think if you have a beautiful idea, you have an idea, you've got an organizing principle around that idea. So if it's, you know, Black women writers writing about erotica, I think I bought a anthology. I also purchased some of the anthologies in the process of this just to understand better, like how you can organize an anthology. I think if you have a great idea, you've got a beautiful ethos and organizing principle around what you want to do, people, you know, are going to submit, you know, if they have something. Now it does take work to get the calls out and to promote, to be able to drum up that interest. One thing that we did do that was a good strategy, it could be a good strategy for somebody starting out, is we did office hours. So during January 2021, oh my goodness, these years are.
Yeah, running all together.
We did a month-long series of office hours to drum up interest and also to just support people who were interested in the project but didn't necessarily know like what they wanted to submit. So we fielded questions, talked through ideas. So that might be also another good, cool way to drum up interest in the project. But
and Zora, you also, sorry not to cut you off, but you also have this community, right? So, you know, if you have an idea or you're looking for submissions, that's all stuff we can include in things that we have pushing out. Like mm-hmm. permission to write exists to be community, to push out, to like, it is not for my glory, like, you know, not for my guts and glory. It's really because I wanted to create avenues and just like be able to support one another. So, you know, we also have the ability to push out things as well. I will say to your point though, Faja, like one of the things that I am learning though is like, it does help to start your networking process as soon as possible. Like mm-hmm. I'm even just kind of running into it with like my debut of like, you know, I realize why an MFA is valuable sometimes because you're like connecting with other authors that you know are going to be published, right? And so like when it came to blurbs and things like that, I just felt like so bad about myself trying to like drum up people who could like blurb my book and like who were actually in my genre, because I know a lot of amazing writers, but they're not necessarily in romance and they want to have the connection, right? Like, so I will always kind of advocate for like, the more you can be doing networking, like even before your idea happens, like just the better off you are. And like, honestly, this community is a good place to start because you're gonna like, you know, run into other writers and things like that. So I just wanna offer that.
Yeah. And once you have people kind of engaged too, you can also leverage them to get more people engaged. Like, hey, so-and-so is submitting a piece. Like we definitely did a lot of that. Like we got this person, you know, name drop a little bit.
I love that. Very smart. There's another question from Constance. How did you stay on top of your own writing during this time of intense editing and logistics for the anthology?
That's a good question.
Did you stay on top of it?
I don't think I did. The book is still floating out here somewhere. I think we, you know, again, I think it is about having a really good co-editor relationship or relationship with your team, right? I think we were all very aware of like what people could handle. Chris is also, again, a PhD student, so he also had a lot of stuff, and he is like one of those people who, very much like you, Ashley, who just does a million things, and I have no idea how you do a million things. Like, Chris always got something else going on. I'm just like, wait, what? Like, do you sleep? Like, what do you do? And I'm always in awe of that. But we were very aware of like our capacity as well too, right? In terms of like, okay, I need to take a break from this. Just communicating, right? Like, okay, I'm going to work on this for this hour and then I'm going to get back to you at 10 o'clock at night. There were a lot of those kind of conversations just in terms of, I got to work on this other thing real quick so that I'll get back to editing these pieces. The COVID pandemic was unfortunately kind of a help to us, because again, we were also able to understand other people's bandwidth, right? Like, if people couldn't submit to stuff on time, it was literally no sweat. Like, we are literally living through unprecedented times. Like, everybody deserves grace, and get it to us when you can get it to us. Here's the drop dead date that we needed, so long as you got it to us by then. It just took a lot of pressure, I think, off of us. Like you said, Constance, trying to do the logistics. It was a lot of back and forth and a lot of email, a lot of calls. But really just communicating, like, I can't work on this today. I need a break.
So big. Even just holding space for people. Like, mm-hmm. I literally told my teams at my full-time job yesterday, I was like, it's okay if y'all need breaks today, because mm-hmm. who getting invited to vote on the Grammys really is not like, like, right. I know we're supposed to sit here and act like this is the most important thing happening right now, but it's really not, you know?
Right.
And I think that's what I'm loving about seeing us as millennials become leaders. Mm-hmm. Because we are gonna, like, our just emotional intelligence is just different. So I love seeing that even in an editorial position, you know, being able to give folks that grace. Other questions, feel free to drop it in the chat, or you can unmute. It's a small group, like, we're just chatting.
Building the team was definitely key. Because I think same, like, just I think being clear and honest, right? Like, Chris and I were like, we have full-time jobs, we've got other projects, this is very important, and we want to make sure we're giving it the time. Oh, Shamika has to hop by, girl.
Thanks for joining, Shamika. It's always good to see you.
It's good to see you too. Good to see you in person. Just giving ourselves that honesty that we would need support. I think another thing that really helped with the anthology process too, and one thing I'm going to like borrow from Chris going forward, he was always really good about asking who has like the final say, like who has the final like sign off on this decision, any particular decision, because we were very much like running gun it, like, okay, we doing this, okay, you want to go do this, do we got, who do we have to send this off to before we can do it, like, can we just go or do we need approval? So I think asking that earlier on in conversations was really helpful, because it just gave us a real clear idea of like who has executive decision over this particular stage in the process, so that we're also not stepping on anybody's toes, so that nobody felt left out in the process. And that helped us to be able to maybe take some of the pressure off of us too, like, okay, this is our decision, we can just go. Okay, it's not our decision. We know who to reach out to be able to get things finalized and in motion. See what Constance is.
Yep, she talked about the title, How We Stay Free.
Free, stay free. Yes. You want to know what's so funny? That title just came right off like the top. Like, Chris had posted about the project very early on, and I'm going to find the Facebook post. He had posted something on Facebook about the project early on. I can't even remember what title he said. And me just being like silly, like my own, you know, foolish self, I just responded to the comment, like, what about how we stay free? And he was like, yes. And I was like, oh, boom, we got it. Like, title is done. In terms of getting that title approved, there were conversations that we had around the title, the implications. It's interesting though, because then after I said, like, I'm reading How We Get Free, of course, then there's like Miriam Kaba's book, that I'm going to blank on the title, We Do This Till We Free Us. It was just right there. So of course, like, this idea of like liberation and us preserving the liberties that we do have, but also fighting to get more liberties, right? The liberties that are owed to us, the liberties that every human being on the planet is old. So I think it was kind of a natural title. We did have some, the cover was a process too, for anybody that's also thinking about logistically putting together an anthology. We did work with a publisher. So maybe to your earlier point, Ashley, very early on, Common Oceans Press is a radical publisher out of Brooklyn, but they also have inroads into Making Worlds bookstore. Malav Kanuga, he runs the bookstore and is also an editor for Common Oceans Press. So he was also brought on very early. And they were very interested in the project, and we originally pitched it to them. So then they decided to do the publishing arm of it. But we worked with them on the cover. And originally, we, of course, it was a Black-led project. So we wanted it to be all Black Philadelphians from like the cover to the very end. We netted out there with a few ally contributors. But the cover, we had a design and a photo that we wanted to be the original cover. And it was really beautiful. It was down City Hall in front of the municipal building. Mm-hmm. And that cover just did not get approved very early on. It was just like, okay, y'all got the executive decision. They were not about that cover. I love the cover that we actually landed on. And Josh McAfee from Common Notions put together this the cover. So
I was going to say, so that final decision was the publisher when it came to cover.
It was the house. It was the Robeson House.
Okay, it was the house. Okay, so you have all these factors. So there was this grant, there mm-hmm. was working with the house, and then there was working with the publisher.
Yep.
And that
trying to bridge those timelines.
Right. In that pitch to the publisher, what did that look like? Did that look like a formal book proposal, or was it more like a meeting?
It was a meeting. Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a meeting. Chris fired off a bunch of texts like, hey, I got this cool project. Are you interested? So we got together, talked about Common Notions. They also publish a lot of collective anthologies. They've done and published books like this before. So they were a really, really great fit. They were definitely interested in the project early on. It did not go the route of a traditional kind of like publisher agreement where they buy the rights to the book. Originally, we were going to like, it was almost kind of like you said, like a pay model. We were going to use the grant funds to pay the publisher. It ultimately landed, though, that they would do a traditional book publishing, agreement. And then we would use the grant money to purchase books for the house and purchase books for like school donations and stuff like that. So it was a bit of a kind of like circulatory agreement, but ultimately we were able to use the funds from the grant to then purchase the books.
Oh, I love it. Cause long term,
yeah,
of course I would want to see like a permission to write anthology just as a way to like, you know, highlight and uplift writers that, you know, might not otherwise have like certain opportunities, but like long term, y'all, we building.
We gonna get there. Yeah, there's a well-read Black girl anthology. Yes, I mean anthologies to me are one, a really beautiful way to get, like you said, writers that have not been published before and are looking for, you know, early on publications to get them involved very early on. They get the editorial support they need to publish. They also have a theme and an idea around like what they want to publish. So it's less pressure that way. Mm-hmm. And I think they're also really beautiful though, because then it's just like a concert of different voices, right? Like I think mm-hmm. I was looking through so many other anthologies. Toby K. Mumbara, I mean, she's edited about like two or three anthologies. And I was looking through them and there was actually one writer, I'm like, I can't remember her name. I have a terrible memory, but she'd written a piece in one of, I think it's The Black Woman. And it was set in Philly and I'd read it and I'd never heard of this writer before. And this anthology was published in, when was The Black Woman published? Probably the 70s. And I tried to go look for more information and there was just no information. It was just the one fixed little short story that she had written in the anthology. And I was like, that's just so beautiful, right? Like how many people who are not like huge names, how many writers that might not have like mainstream success, but you can find their work in an anthology. And I think that's also one of the beautiful things about anthologies, right? That they bring together all of these different voices.
What I know you've done a bunch of different, you know, events, and just like, of course, like a book comes with promotion. You got to be out here telling people about it. What do you feel is something you haven't been asked about the project that you would want to share?
Oh, that's a good question. The events have been amazing. I think Chris and I, in doing the promo, we definitely wanted to center all of the contributors and all of their work. So at each of our book events, we've invited contributors to participate, like based on their different areas. We just did one with the Asian Arts Initiative, where we had Charlene and Gina, who do mutual aid work, talk about their mutual aid work, with Dr. Jessica, who is a professor, who chronicled mutual aid work throughout Black history. So that was just a beautiful experience. I think the best ones have been where, like, we don't have to talk about the book, which is like weird, right? Like, we just talk about like the ideas in the book. Those have been really beautiful. Mm-hmm. But what I haven't been asked, oh my God, I feel like I've been asked so much stuff. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm stumped.
It's all good. That is not my purpose. My purpose is just that, like, you know, coming from like a journalism background, like there tends to be like, you know, this kind of slate of questions, right? Like, how'd you find the contributors? How'd you do, you know what I mean? Like, and there's normally just like something that people feel really like kind of connected to about their piece that like they never actually get asked, but they would love to share. Like, you know what I mean?
I think I have one. I think I do. Not that we do get asked this, like what's the hope for the book? And I want to say, I think that's actually one of your questions.
It is.
But I think I never really get to say too that, like, for me, one of the big hopes is that people who are not in movement spaces, and I don't want to say are not like knowledgeable, because I feel like it's so much a part of the larger conversation of our world today, right? Like, these are not kind of like, you know, auxiliary conversations. They don't just exist in woke conscious circles anymore, right? Like, this is mainstream conversation, which is great and beautiful. But even still, like, people, again, like you said, these are not things that we're taught in school, right? Like, this is why we're having a whole conversation about critical race theory, right? Because a lot of this stuff has not been taught to people. The thing that I would really love and want people to take away from it for me was that, like, people who are not in movement spaces, who maybe like 2020 was their first protest, who are really maybe just now coming to understanding about what has been going on in the world. I feel like Black people have always been, marginalized people have always been aware, but if not, that is fine. Like, for me, I would like that the book be an open space in that way, that people can come to it and say, oh snap, I did not know that there was an organization that does mutual aid out of Malcolm X Park. Oh crap, I did not know that there is a whole entire housing justice movement going on. And I got a cousin who's been dealing with PHA, and now I know who to go to figure out how to get their needs met, right? For me, I think that was really, really important. And it's really funny because when I first, right when the protest, right after George Floyd's murder, like as all these things were coming up and we watching CNN all day, we watching this and we watching that, I just stopped and was like, who are all the people in the city that are doing stuff? Like, I just did not know, right? It was my own ignorance. I started doing research online, putting together a spreadsheet, pulling together all the different organizations just that I saw out and about. And it's really cool because I feel like the book then kind of functions as like this living, breathing spreadsheet, right? Like, if there are organizations here, I love for us to be able to include more on the website and just have it be this really cool access point and like education tool for people that are interested in this kind of information.
Yeah, I love the fact that you have like a complimentary online space to that point of just kind of being able to keep the conversation going. I think it's so key and critical. I love also just when, like, kind of like I mentioned before, people make it easy. Like, when certain things were going on, like, here are the bail funds. Like, okay, yes, that is how I can like be a part of it, you know, because yeah. I just remember sitting home and being like, I gotta go out here. I want to do something. And my husband looking at me like, ma'am, because if somebody hits you, everybody gonna die. So no.
And it's COVID. And like, yeah. So there were so many factors, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But like that there are ways that you can be involved. And like, here is a list, right? Mm-hmm. Taking away Yeah, I'm big on taking away all the judgment. Like, listen, people don't know what they don't know, and that's fine, right? Because we're all trying to live our lives. But like, if we can make that information accessible and easy for people to engage with, then like, let's do it.
Absolutely. Love it. Any other last questions at all from those that are still with us? And I know a lot of people will be watching this on our video archive as well. Just we in the middle of the day, people got jobs.
Wow, they're actually doing this. And you guys just did a writing hour. I need to come and make that like my Friday.
You know what? I am off on Fridays. So So that's why I like a lot of stuff I try to hit on Fridays. So we started the PTW writing hour, of course, in the pandemic, right? Like just looking for ways of community. And we've been going so strong. And it started like, I feel like it was bi-weekly. And then everybody was like, we need to do this like every week. And then we amped it up. So I tend to try to keep a lot of writing stuff on Friday. Look, trying to manage, I work like an alternative work week. So I work 10-hour days, Monday through Thursday.
That's cool.
And y'all, I got a budget to turn in. So I'm working after this. Like, listen, I'm like, I'm going to make myself some breakfast and then work on this daggone budget I need to turn in for the real gig, you know? So
it's I'm happy you're in LA, but I'm also so sad you're in LA. I'm like, oh no, we can't go. Me. I think I forget. Like you used to just say breakfast. I'm like, oh wait, yeah, she's in LA.
Oh yes, yes. Cause it's, I forgot. It's almost 2 o'clock on these calls. It is 10:54. I'm about to do a whole brunch situation.
But that's very cool that you have Fridays off. Yeah. So thinking about how to stagger my like writing to this, mostly it's the weekends. Yeah. But
literally trying to manage the writing. So once I sold the book, they offered that. I was like, thank you, India.
Thank you, India.
So much for joining. But it was literally about trying to like make time for edits. So like y'all, we just be having to figure it out when it comes to balancing all this stuff. Cause I know that was one of the questions, like it's literally figuring it out. Like I have written so much draft copy and like book copy stuff, like between the hours of 7 to 9 o'clock, because I'm literally just squeezing in like 2 hours of writing before I start work. So
thank you so much, Audrey.
Yeah. Thanks, Audrey. Well, we'll wrap. Any last thoughts, Faja, before we wrap? Because I know everybody's jumping off.
Thank you so much for this. Thank you for permission to write. Just awesome. This is awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for this piece. Everybody, y'all make sure y'all grab this book. Like I'm really looking forward to it, because even just like reading through like quickly and trying to like, I was just skipping to people's names I kind of knew. but I'm gonna go back and read everything. It felt so good, like just quick and just trying to like, you know, acquaint my own self and further like my own knowledge. Like you say, really taking the judgment out of it. This is an everybody problem. It's not just like a Black or marginalized people. It's an everybody problem. You know, as Ms. Morrison said, sometimes she'd be like, this is other people's problem, not even ours.
Let them deal with it.
You know, so yes, we thank you, Faja, for taking the time. Don't take it for granted at all. You spend this time with us.
Thank you.
Whatever we can do to continue to support, we will absolutely do. So
thank you guys so much for joining.
Yes. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Zora. Thanks, Constance.
And I hope you all have such a great weekend.
Yes.
Thank you for listening to PTW Office Hours. We hope you got something out of the conversation. You can follow us on Instagram at Permission to Write, on Twitter at Perm to Write, and stay up to date through our website, permissiontowrite.com. Join our community that works to amplify and cultivate the voices of Black writers and writers of color.